Well, great to have you with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's the first Tuesday of the month, and that means we talk sports with you. And today we'll start by talking about track and field and what it takes to become a national champion. We have Chip Schneider with us on, I think by way of meet, maybe on the phone. He's the head coach for men's indoor and outdoor track and field at UW-Eau Claire. He also serves as director of cross country. Oh, we have David. We do not have Chip. We instead have our second guest for today's show. You know, things happen around here at Wisconsin Public Radio and other stations when something like this comes up. And I tell you what, I have been looking forward to talking with David Barrett. And we're lucky to get him on the line right away. Here we are, the 86th edition of the Masters Golf Tournament takes place this weekend. In fact, it's going on kind of right now. And we'll talk with him about his book. And in his book, he talks about how the event started, how it became one of the year's major tournaments, or one of the world's major tournaments. And his book is titled The Story of the Masters, Drama, Joy, and Heartbreak at Golf's Most Iconic Tournament. Well, are you a fan of the Masters? Have you ever visited? What questions you have about this year's event? What about the history of the Masters? We'd love to hear from you. You can join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. David, of course, as I mentioned, three decades of work relating to golf, among other things. He was senior editor at Golf Magazine and has covered 24 Masters. He's the author of 7 books. And again, his latest, we'll talk with him about The Story of the Masters, Drama, Joy, and Heartbreak at Golf's Most Iconic Tournament. It's just been released in paperback, and I really enjoyed going through it. David Barrett, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Are you at Augusta today, or?
No, I'm not making the trip this year. Yeah, 24 times I've been there, though, so that's pretty good.
Oh, that I'm telling you, I haven't been there once yet, and I'm trying to get there, and maybe next year.
Yes.
I keep hoping. You've written so much about golf. How did you get interested in golf?
Well, I started playing when I was 12 years old, and I was a big sports fan, and so I was kind of also became a fan of pro golf. So then I became a sports writer at newspapers. That was my first job. And the second newspaper I worked at was the Augusta Chronicle. So, so that's when I started covering the Masters as a young sports writer. Golf was already one of my passions as far as, you know, things to cover and things I knew a lot about, the pro tour and stuff like that. So, so from the Augusta Chronicle, I ended up going to Golf Magazine. So, and I was there for 18 years. So
that's a pretty good stretch.
Yeah. So that's kind of how I ended up focusing on golf as opposed to being, you know, covering all sports. Just serendipitous that I happened to get the job at the Augusta Chronicle. And then, then, you know, the editors at Golf Magazine, when I was looking to, you know, maybe move there, they knew me from being in Augusta and reading the paper while they were there. So it was great.
Oh, man. And I'll tell you right now, I have my edition of Golf Magazine to my left. I have the April edition. And to my right, I have your book, The Story of the Masters, Drama, Joy, and Heartbreak at Golf's Most Iconic Tournament. And I really enjoyed going through your book. It's for somebody who loves to play golf and who certainly loves the Masters Golf Tournament. I was reading it with great relish. And, you know, you took a little different tack from some of the books. You take the tourney, we start with a little history, but then you take the tourney year by year. And why did you do it that way?
Well, you've referred to other golf books that have covered the history of the those books tended to focus on the club aspects of Augusta National. And I thought it was kind of odd that no book had, like, taken a comprehensive review of the tournament itself, because, you know, it's the tournament that probably everybody looks forward to more than any other. It's the tournament that has created great memories through the years. And I just thought that people would enjoy kind of looking back, going over it again, reflecting on what happened for, you know, the tournaments they saw, and learning about the early history, since, you know, tradition is such a great part of it. So, yeah, it seemed like kind of a hole in golf literature. So I was glad to be able to do it.
I was really, and the amount of additional information, sort of inside comments and so forth, that you have in the book are really kind of wonderful, and I know it must have been fun to write this book or put this book together, but at the same time, it must have been a heck of a lot of work. How long did you spend on this book?
It was a lot of research. The writing of the book took maybe close to a year and a half, but, you know, not full time that whole time. But, kind of the basis for most of it was just reviewing the Augusta Chronicle coverage. And then supplementing that with the magazine articles and some other newspapers and books that had been written about various tournaments, various years and whatever.
It was a lot. It's a lot of fun to read. And I imagine you also, because you covered it for 24 years, you probably had some things you could have probably popped in off the top of your head, but maybe needed to refresh the memory a little bit.
Yeah, I even had kept some of my handwritten notes from post round interviews that actually, in a couple instances, came in handy. So,
David Barrett, our guest today, his book, The Story of the Masters, Drama, Joy, and Heartbreak at Golf's Most Iconic Tournament. Questions for him about the tournament itself or about the Augusta course? I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. So let's talk a bit about the history of, I want to go way back, because I don't think that everybody knows how Augusta Golf Course got started. I mean, as I read that portion, you know, right away in the beginning, I thought, oh, this is really interesting, because I you know, I'd kind of heard a little, but I hadn't realized how the darn course got built in the first place.
Yeah, well, that had to do with Bobby Jones, the great amateur who was from Georgia, Atlanta, and won the Grand Slam, what was then the Grand Slam of the U.S. Open, British Open, U.S. Amateur, British Amateur in 1930, and retired from the game at age 28. And his dream was to, you know, have a golf club and build a golf course. And Augusta was the place he ended up choosing to do it. And that's how the course got
going. And it was
going in 1933, basically, or late 32.
Yeah, wasn't it originally a tree farm or something?
It was a nursery.
A nursery.
A tree nursery and plant nursery. Actually, one of the top ones in the Southeast that was very innovative in its time in like the late 19th century. But that family business came to an end, and so the property was sitting there, and somebody had thought about building a hotel there in the 20s, but that didn't happen. And then the Depression happened, and it was just property was just kind of sitting there. And the guy who was the mayor of Augusta, or I don't remember if he was the mayor yet, but he showed Jones and his partner Clifford Roberts the property, and they said Jones later wrote that, you know, he looked at it and saw that it was just waiting for a golf course to be built on it.
Yeah, and Clifford Roberts, I think, wasn't he a banker out of New York? And
he was, yep, an investment banker,
and stayed and wound up. throughout his career, as sort of the head guy at the,
He became the chairman of both the Masters and the Augusta National Golf Club, and was kind of famous for ruling with an iron hand. But while Jones was alive, he certainly was a strong influence as well.
You know, the Masters, it's an invitational, and, you know, maybe for those who, there may be people not familiar, in this case, what does that mean? How do you get invited?
Well, they have criteria that they set up, so it's pretty cut and dried. You're invited, but you're invited based on qualifying, based on, you know, being one of the top 30 players on the PGA Tour, winning a PGA Tour event, finishing the top four of the U.S. Open or the other majors. So basically, you earn your invitation. The top 50 world ranking is one of the qualifications. So it used to be that the United States players' invitations were pretty cut and dried, but they kind of picked and chose among international players. There's a lot of discretion there. But after the world ranking came along, it's that pretty much. I mean, technically, they can still invite any international player that they want, but they rarely end because they pretty much go off the top 50 of the world ranking.
Yeah, there's always an amateur element to it. Always has been, probably because of Bobby Jones,
right?
And so there are amateurs who I imagine win national amateur championships that are invited.
Yeah, it's the the winner and runner-up at the U.S. Amateur, the winner at the British Amateur, the winner of the U.S. Public Links Tournament, which is for amateurs age 25 and over. And
they get to come and stay overnight if they want to in right on the course.
Yeah.
In the crow's nest?
Yep. And just to complete the amateurs, I should mention, because it's significant in what's happening, what Augusta National has been doing, they started a tournament called the Asia Pacific Amateur and another one called the Latin American Amateur. So the champions of those two events also are invited. And yes, there is a place, a kind of a attic at the top of the clubhouse, if you will, but called the Crow's Nest, where they have beds and facilities for the amateurs to stay right on the grounds in the clubhouse if they choose, which most of them do.
Talking today with David Barrett, his book, The Story of the Masters, Drama, Joy, and Heartbreak at Golf's Most Iconic Tournament. Questions for him, I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us, the email address, ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. Jill Nadeau, our producer, Trina LaSousa, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. The iconic music introducing us by CBS television to the Masters Golf Tournament. Oh, man. Our guest, David Barrett, his book, The Story of the Masters, subtitled Drama, Joy, and Heartbreak at Golf's Most Iconic Tournament. Questions for him. I hope you'll join in. Maybe you've attended the Masters Golf Tournament. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, ideas@WPR.org. You know, you think tradition, and the televising of the Masters Golf Tournament is a sight to behold for me. I bet it is for you too, David. And
yeah.
It's really something what they do.
Yeah, it is. It was very helpful for the book research, in fact, that from about 1967 on, those final round broadcasts are on YouTube, so... you can relive the tournaments that way, or in my case, research the tournaments that way.
I've got to just mention one story that I've sometimes told my students. You know, I teach a broadcast class here at the University of Wisconsin, and I tell the story of the year the Masters, televisions. Was showing, of course, these beautiful scenes, and you could hear the birds singing in the background as they kind of panned across the course a bit. And then they suddenly started getting a whole bunch of phone calls from irate listeners who also happened to be birders. And I don't know if you remember that story or not, but they were using bird songs. They weren't using the actual birds at the Masters. They were using some bird sound effects, and the birds they were using, unbeknownst to them, were not birds that you'd find near Augusta, and birders got mad about it.
Yeah. Yeah, so sometimes they embellish it a little bit too much. But, yeah. There's also stories about, true stories, I think, about... The the club putting blue dye in the water hazards. To make,
Oh man! Was there anything surprising, or what surprised you the most, or did you discover about the Masters as you kind of look back for that through your research for the book, or maybe something you'd forgotten about, but oh man, I forgot about that.
Strangely enough, one of the things that made me think, oh man, I'd forgotten about that, is actually a pretty famous event. But so Tiger Woods winning his fourth straight major in 2001.
Tiger Slam.
Yeah, the Tiger Slam. So, when people look back at the greatest Masters, they think about Nicklaus in 75, Nicklaus in 86, Woods in 19, which I agree with. And you know, Tiger has won five times, and he won again the next year after that in 2002. I had it in my mind that, you know, that was a great achievement for Tiger, winning four majors in a row, but I didn't remember as much about the tournament itself as I thought, and I was kind of thinking, well, he won kind of easily. And so it turned out he was actually in a dogfight for the entire final round with Phil Mickelson and David Duval, who were the two other top players at the time. And, coming down to the 16th hole, he was like one ahead of both of them. And he ended up birdieing 18 to win by two. So that was a tournament that I think should be remembered more for the tournament itself than it is. Or maybe it's just me who forgot. I don't know.
Well, let's take a call. Nancy in Madison, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I know because, it's in Georgia. It's a pretty racist state. And I'm wondering it was just a few years before Tiger that they realized that golfers weren't all white.
So when did the color barrier break, David?
Yeah, so the first black golfer to play in the Masters was Lee Elder in 1975. And there was a lot of talk in the years before that they should invite a black player. And it's kind of a complicated issue, but who knows what they would have done in the, 50s when segregation was a thing in Georgia. But the thing was that there weren't many segregation was a thing in golf, and there weren't, black players playing the tour. And then so in the late 1960s, they kind of tweaked the invitation categories to make it easier for top players on the PGA Tour to get in. And it wasn't, it was kind of just to make sure that they weren't leaving out any top players, but also, by then, there were some black players on tour, so at that point, it gave them a better chance to qualify. But just from the late 60s through the early 70s, none of them happened to qualify. So, that was the time when, Augusta was really being criticized for not inviting a black player. I don't want to make too many excuses for them, but, during those years, if a black player had qualified, he would have been invited. So they were probably kind of hoping that one would to kind of end the controversy. And Yeah, so Lee Elder finally won a tournament in 74 and got in 75.
And I'm trying to remember, was it this last year that he got to be on the first tee with Jack Nicklaus and hit the first honorary shot to start the Masters?
Yes, they did invite him to do that in the past year. He actually wasn't able to physically hit a shot at that point, but he was part of the ceremony, which was great.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, Lee has passed away since then.
Yeah, shortly after, actually. Bruce in La Crosse, let's go to you. Hi, Bruce.
Yes. Hello, gentlemen. This is bringing back some memories. I was stationed at Eisenhower Medical Center from 1972 to 1974 after being drafted out of college in Stevens Point. And during that time, soldiers were allowed to go to the Masters for $5. And so and we had to wear a tag. I still have my tags, and I've got the pairings and starting time for 1974. But my friend and I attended the Masters on the Fridays. We couldn't attend on the last 2 days, but the Thursday and Friday. And we attended, like I said, on two Fridays and got there early and walked through the course, probably one of the most beautiful places I've ever seen on Earth once they get it completely tuned up. Ended up sitting at the 16th hole, which is the par three, and watching all the famous guys go through and then follow them up as the last on the 17th and the last on the 18th, got to the top, and Mamie Eisenhower and Chris Schenkel, Mamie at the time, I'm not sure if this was 73 or 74, but Mamie at the time lived on the golf course, and needless to say, we weren't allowed to get close to them, but we did have a great couple of days.
Oh, and if it was 1974, I think Gary Player won in 1974. Beat Dave Stockton and Weisskopf, I think, by a couple of strokes.
That would be your guess.
Yeah, 74, he did. It was Gary Player. And let's see, who did he beat there? You're right, Dave Stockton and Tom Weisskopf.
You know why I'm right? Because I had your book in front of me.
Okay.
And that's one of the kind of the fun things about the book. You can kind of page through, and one nice thing you've got there in a little box every year, you've got the who won and then who, you know, down the top 10 players or so. As soon as Bruce mentioned 74, I opened your book and I was quickly able to find one.
Okay. Yeah, one thing that comes to mind from that is when people get to go to the Masters, it's a highly anticipated thing, but it's like almost never a letdown. It's like wow. Yeah, it's just as good as people think it is.
You know, I have friends and some family members who have gone, and everybody comes back talking about how inexpensive everything is. The pimento sandwiches, they're $1.50 this year for a sandwich. And I think beer was $5 this year, which is the cheapest that you're going to find in any tournament.
Yeah, for a sports event, they don't need to make money off concessions. So, fortunately, they don't gouge the people. Yeah.
I'm thinking back to Harry Hills Golf Course in the Madison area a few years back when I happened to go there on Masters Week, and they were selling pimento sandwiches for a buck and a half.
Oh, wow.
in honor of the Masters tournament. Oh, man. You can join in, too, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. You know, you can't talk about the Masters without talking about Arnold Palmer and Jack Nicklaus. What's a favorite story that you have about them at the Masters?
Well, let's see. So Arnold won in 58, 60, 62, and 64. And he, you know, he was obviously a charismatic figure.
And Jack Nicklaus at that, and when he came on board, I mean, people were loved Arnie so much that he was kind of seen by some people in a kind of a negative light because he was challenging Arnie.
That kind of turned around maybe in 1966. When Jack set the course record, tournament record for 72 holes of 271, and won in such an impressive performance that he
sort of turned it around.
Turned it around, and he remembers, you know, being encouraged by the fans, and that he later wrote in his autobiography how much that meant to him.
Who do you think is one of the best players not to win the Masters? I was thinking about David Duval. David Duval, I know in 2001, I think he lost to Tiger by one stroke. And then 2002, I think he was right up there. And then suddenly he just took a nosedive.
Yeah. His career, his game just left him. He was one of the top players for maybe a period of 5 or 6 years there.
Won the British Open.
Won the British Open, contended in the Masters a few times. But for players who had more longevity as top players in the game and didn't win the Masters, I guess the two that come to mind are Lee Trevino and Greg Norman. So.
Yeah. Yeah, and of course you write about Greg Norman's collapse. I forget the year now.
1996.
1996, when he had a pretty nice lead.
Yeah, he led by 6 strokes going into the final round and shot a 78, while Nick Faldo shot a 67, so he ended up losing by 5, yeah.
I actually remember watching that on TV, and I was just cringing and feeling so sorry for him at the time, because you and I both know how your game can kind of leave you a little bit.
Yeah, that happened at the wrong time, obviously. And it also happened the guy he was playing with was having a great round. So,
yeah.
And, you know, he came close a few other times, and either some other self-inflicted wounds or else somebody else played great. But,
Or made some miraculous shot. Well, look to this year, and of course, we don't have this year in your book, but you bring it right. It's right up to date. But here we go with some really good players out there. And I just learned that Tiger so far is still considering planning to play, and he's going to shoot 9 holes tomorrow. And that's probably when he'll have to make up his mind tomorrow whether or not he plays. Do you think he'll play?
It looks like he's certainly leaning that way. He wouldn't have, you know, come there if he didn't hope to play. And from all indications, you know, it's been going okay. He's been playing just 9 holes each day, although he did jet in last week and had one 18-hole day. And then after coming back Sunday, he's been playing 9 holes. Each day, and you know, the main question is probably just walking the course. It's a very hilly course, not an easy walk, especially with somebody whose leg has been reconstructed like Tiger. It'd be a very difficult course to walk, but It looks like, you know, that's the only question. If he decides that he can play, walk the course for 18 holes for 4 days, but I think he's on track to do it.
Yeah, and you know what? If he doesn't, he'll probably be right in the hunt, although I tend to think maybe Justin Thomas is probably about time for him to win one.
Yeah, that's a good call. He's been playing very well lately. Hasn't won a major since the one he won in like 2017, 2018 PGA. As far as Tiger, I would be surprised if he actually contends if he plays, but
stranger things have happened. You'd have to add another chapter to your book for sure.
I know. For sure.
Scotty Scheffler is now the number one player in the world, and he told a funny story because when he was going to, the volunteer was taking him to the tournament up the drive or whatever. Of course, Scotty's just number one, but the driver called him Xander. And he sort of Xander Schauffele confused him with Xander Schauffele, and he said, "Well, that kind of brought me back down to earth."
Yeah, that's funny, Schauffele and Scheffler. Yeah.
Well, I will be tuned in. It's one of those weekends where I spend more time in front of the television than is normal for me for a weekend. But I'll definitely be clued into the Masters, and I'm frankly great to have a copy of your book right near me when I'm watching, and I'll be using the book and doing a little remembering as I go through the tournament. It's been a pleasure, David. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us. I really appreciate it.
Well, thanks a lot. I've enjoyed it. Yeah.
David Barrett, his book is The Story of the Masters, and the subtitle is Drama, Joy, and Heartbreak at Golf's Most Iconic Tournament. I tell you what, it's a treat for the eyes, and as I'm not mistaken, it is the most watched golf tournament, and one of the reasons for it is that a lot of people who don't golf will tune in to the Masters Golf Tournament because it's so beautiful and it's so iconic, very iconic. Well, I'll tell you what, we're going to turn our attention to national champions next. And we have the UW Men's Eau Claire track and field team coach next on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.